place here that we've been in this semester, I guess, since September.
September.
Yeah. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Dallas Philosophy Forum, it's been in existence for 35, 40 years, was founded by a couple of professional philosophers. The philosophers who are now on the board and the officers are kind of semi-professional. we're not academic philosophers, but we are interested in philosophy. And our subjects aren't always just pure philosophy. We have science, literature, art, sociology, politics, all kinds of things. So I'd like to ask our audience, are there any new attendees for the first time? Oh, great, great. How did you hear from us, about us?
Miranda Barnier.
Oh, great, good. Over here.
Get you up on the meetup.
Mita? Mita?
Yep.
Over here?
Carrie.
Okay. She brought you and you brought her, right? Over here, anybody? Okay. Yes.
Mita.
Okay. Yes, we have a, we pay them a lot of money.
It's on the list.
Okay, a few little, do's and don'ts. Put your cell phones on silent.
Yeah, right.
And make sure that you take care of your wait staff. You pay your bill. You pay. You give them a little tip. Philosophy's not for free. We do have our expenses. Our treasurer is David Drum. He's going to hold up his hand. Pay him $5 for the privilege of hearing Dr. Cockrell tonight. And if you're a full-time student, it's only $2. Okay. I really have the pleasure of introducing a long-term colleague and close acquaintance, Dr. Clay Cockrell. We've been, known each other for over 30 years, right?
Yes.
So Dr. Cockrell is a clinical professor of dermatology and pathology and is the director of dermatopathology at UT Southwestern Medical School, where he actively teaches. He's from Lubbock, Texas, and is a... Abilene College. Third generation dermatologist. Father, grandfather. Received his medical degree from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and then his residency and fellowship in New York University Medical Center in New York City. Of course, Texas was in his blood, so he had to come back here to Texas in 1988, and he's been here ever since. He's the founder of Cockrell Dermopathology, and he practices both dermatology and dermopathology, which is a subspecialty of both dermatology and pathology. He's a past president of the American Academy of Dermatology, which is dermatologists' big national organization. And he's an author of over 500 publications on the editorial board of several medical journals. Our true Renaissance man earned two MBA degrees, both in general business and commercial real estate, and he's pursuing a law degree now. He and his wife, Brenda, are the owners of a commercial winery in California, and they produce many cases, 35,000 cases.
3,500.
Oh, not thousands, okay. That's small. but he's a real man of field. Dr. Cockle has been interested in many issues related to burnout in medicine and has developed a course that he has taught in a number of different settings using the Tao Te Ching as a basis for discussion. And we're going to have a kind of a unique situation here that we're going to have an interaction between with the speaker and the audience as he presents a number of passages from the Tao, and he's going to seek your participation about their meanings and interpretation. So it's my pleasure to present Dr. Cockle.
It's on the. Okay. Let me turn it off. Yeah, just hold the left side of the button until it turns green. If it isn't, I'll do it.
There we go.
Okay.
Can they hear me?
It helps if I turn you on.
Here we go.
All
right. Can you hear me okay? Well, thank you, David. David's the one who invited me here, and I'd never heard of the Dallas Philosophers Forum until he said something about it. I'm not sure what meetup is, but it sounds like it's a pretty good deal for you guys, so maybe I'll have to come another time. So, looks good. How many people have heard of the Tao machine? Well, it's a philosopher's symposium. Of course, you all have heard of it, right? How many of you have actually read the whole thing? Oh, great! I'll sit back, I can order a glass of wine! Well, this is actually dedicated to my good friend, Dr. Stuart M. Brown. I don't know if any of you knew him, but he's a dermatologist, David knows him. And Stu had the joie de vivre, if you will. Stu loved life, and he was just a great guy. And the thing that killed Stu, though, was his cheapness. He would never valet park. And so he started teaching over at the University of North Texas Medical Center in Fort Worth, and so he was driving himself there every day. And I said, Stu, you don't need to be driving. If you got to sit in a car with Stu the last few years of his life, it was like going on a roller coaster. You didn't know where the heck he was going. And he ran off the road, bonked his head, and he went the next day and bonked his head again, and he never woke up. So if he would have listened to me, he'd still be alive. He was a great guy. That's my wife, Brenda, giving him a kiss there.
He'd still be drinking wine.
He'd still be drinking wine. So Johnny, he drinks honey and the rocks with a twist. And so we always, when we give a medical talk, we have to give disclosures. Well, I don't have any medical disclosures tonight. But I do disclose that I'm not a guru, I'm not a spiritual master, I'm not an enlightened person. Okay, so I'm just a guy that is here to hopefully share some of these things with you that are kind of interesting. So it is a spiritual session. It's not really a lecture. We have a little bit of lecture at the beginning, and I hope you're not unhappy, but Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy. So it's a spiritual, not a spirit. Even though I am in the wine business. So where did this symposium, where did this come from? Well, you know, I have a medical education seminar that David mentioned, and we put this on in Beaver Creek, Colorado. We've been doing it after 7 years. And the first year we put it on, a number of my former trainees that I teach came and said, I'm so sick and tired of medicine. I hate it. I want to get out of it. I'm burned out. And these are people that are, you know, 25, 30 years younger than I am. And I'm not thinking about getting out. My granddad was 90 when he finally quit practicing. So I said, well, gosh, if all my trainees are burned out, maybe I need to try to do something to help them with this. So that's why I did this lecture. This is a modified version of it with not as much medical stuff in it. But anyway, more than 50%, actually, there's an article I just read today, says 68% of doctors are burned out. That's pretty serious when you think about it. And, you know, dermatology, you don't tend to think of their burned out, but actually we are the fastest rising rate of burnout of all medicine. We've always been kind of low in dermatology, but the rate of rise is highest in dermatology. We've gone to zero to about the fifth or sixth. So it's really kind of scary because these are people that are taking care of you. They're in the hospital and you're sick and your doctor is depressed or burned out to think they're going to be making the best decisions.
Yeah.
So it's a serious issue. And it actually is sort of a sub-issue of what's going on in the entire United States, really. There's this Sanjay Gupta, who all you've heard of, he's on CNN, and he did a very good show on, I think it's HBO, One Nation Under Stress. He's got a book on that. I highly recommend watching that. But he talks about the fact that our life expectancy today is lower than it was in the 60s.
Yeah. And by the way, if you want to take pictures of any of these slides, you're more than welcome to. Okay, these are not proprietary, so you're welcome to take photographs of anything. And the deaths here are really due to things like suicide, cirrhosis, opioid overdoses, things like that. They call them the deaths of despair. So our country is in stress, and it's reflective in everything we deal with. Stress causes anatomical changes in your actual brain. So it actually causes your limbic system and your brain system to actually become larger relative than it does if you don't have stress. So actually, if you kind of look at some of these little formulas here, and I don't take credit for the top one, I do take a little bit of credit for the bottom one, because that's not anywhere. But this one is true. The suffering is, and those of you who've read this book and know that Buddhist philosophy a little bit, equals pain times resistance. Not pain plus resistance, pain times resistance. You've all heard of no pain, no gain. If you can get rid of the resistance, pain you're always going to have, some pain. But if you get rid of resistance, you don't have to necessarily have suffering. So there's a distinction there between the two. So yeah, if you have a hangnail and you keep picking at it, you're going to suffer. But if you deal with it quickly and not resistance to it, it can kind of go away. So pain's inevitable, suffering is optional. Now the opposite of that is joy. If you do pleasure, which are pleasurable things like this wonderful weather we had today, if you didn't go out and enjoy that or accept that or allow yourself to take pleasure, and again, just the times works here too, you can lower your joy. And if you don't have any joy, you get burned out. So that's how these things kind of work. And you can easily sabotage your joy if you don't accept pleasure. Well, how many of you get a compliment from someone saying, oh, I don't deserve that? We're sort of raised to do that in our era. You know? But that's not good. That's not a good thing necessarily to do. So what is pain? Well, you have physical pain, and you can have emotional pain. And, you know, if you read in the literature or whatever, they talk about the causes of psychic pain. If you actually go and look at a definition of that, frustrated psychological needs, threat to social connection, unhealthy cravings. These are things that create psychic pain. And the default mode of us, we just have a four-week-old grandson now, so we see what the default mode there is of a perfect human being born. It's basically quietude. It's not stress. It's not anxiety. It's not all the kind of stuff that happens in our society that turns my little grandson into that as time goes on, sadly enough. And so there's a Buddhist guy named Ajahn Brahm who talks about the fact that a parable that the mind is kind of like a leaf. If the wind isn't blowing, it's still. But when all the wind is blowing, the unhealthy cravings, the constant bombardments, the wants, all those kind of things, that causes the leaves to rustle and to be not still. So if you can learn how to still the turbulent winds of this constant craving, you can learn to be more at peace. So what are some tools that you can learn to help to still those winds, those tornadic winds like we just had the other night? Well, these are some things I'll just kind of go through. I might read all these to you. I'll just kind of show you some examples. So a lot of people will say yoga is a good thing to do, but there's a quote that says you really can't yoga yourself out of burnout. You really need to have some sort of spiritual practice on top of yoga. And we talked about Wayne Dyer at our table. I love Wayne Dyer. I've been listening to him for over 30-some-odd years. I had a chance to go to one of his seminars, and actually, I do have one regret about him. I actually saw him at the Los Angeles LAX airport probably about 8 or 9 years ago before he passed away, and I started to go up and say something to him. But I said, yeah, you know, celebrities don't like to be bothered, so I didn't say anything to him. I kind of wish I had, you know, just, you know, really, because he probably would have been nice and said, well, thank you for telling me how much you really appreciate all this stuff. But his stuff is really, really super good. And he actually, we're talking about the Tao this evening, he actually spent an entire year living by each one of the 81 little verses of the Tao. Just, well, today I'm going to live by this one. You know, next week I'm going to live by this one. And he talks about it in this book, in this CD that you can listen to. It's really fascinating, so I recommend you looking at that. The Greater Good Science Center's got a website that you can go to. It's in University of California, Berkeley. There's lots of great stuff on there, so I highly recommend this to you as well if you haven't seen this. It's a very good website that's got a lot of fascinating things. Meditation. You know, back when we were growing up, meditation was done by some swami with a beard and had a turban. Well, now it's pretty much mainstream. There's call apps, there's all these apps on your phone you can get, and they're teaching us how to be mindful and to meditate. So this is something that's very good here. I think as Westerners, and it certainly as compulsive doctors and lawyers and people like that, we sort of try to do meditation, where meditation is really sort of a way of being. And if you try to do it right, you're doomed. You can't meditate right or wrong. It's all about being here, then going offside, then getting back, and it's constantly, it's the movement back away from where your mind gets distracted that's actually the thing that strengthens you. So it's really almost kind of like working out in your brain. And so I'm going to meditate to get to nirvana. Well, there really isn't a place to go, nirvana. It's here. And that's what you kind of learn in meditation. I mean, have you ever heard of the central nervous system default mode network? Any neuroscientists in the room? One gentleman has. Good. What is the default mode network? Well, how many of you ever wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning worried about stuff? Come on, be honest. Well, what's really happening there is the committee goes into session at that time of night, and that's your default mode network at work. Your brain never turns off. Even when you're sound asleep, the deepest REM sleep that you're in, your brain is very active. You can functional MRI scans of that. So this is the default mode network. That's what's happening with all these sort of thoughts. So when you're meditating, you'll have a comfort about breathing, and then you start thinking about, you know, have something at work to think about. Go back to concentrating on whatever the type of meditation you're doing, that default network is what gets in the way. And the more you practice meditation, the more you kind of get in control of this default mode network. And the guys that are like the Buddhist meditators and those guys, their functional MRI show that this thing is in a very, very low state. So it is something you can kind of learn and train to make that better, if you will, by doing things like that. We talk about resistance being the thing that you want to get rid of in your life. And again, that's not like giving up. That's not really what it is. It's more kind of being in flow with things, not being in harmony with things. It's a different kind of thing than saying, well, I give up, I surrender. Yeah, surrender is okay if you do it the right way. But if you say you're just going to give up on something, that's really not what it's about. And so it's kind of like what this famous Zen master, Shunryu Suzuki, said, is that the best way to sort of govern people, to deal with people, we'll talk about this when we talk about the Tao in a couple minutes, is like to give your sheep or cows a large, spacious meadow and let them roam around in that meadow. You don't want to try to control them. It doesn't work very well. You want to let them kind of do what they want to do, but not ignore them either. That's the way to control, that's the way to govern people. And we'll talk about that a little bit as the Tao has a passage that deals with that. Some other forms of meditation, mindfulness meditation, we've all heard of that. That's very, very very common today. Loving kindness, walking meditation. I'll just show you a couple of examples of some of these things. So mindful meditation, there's a nice book by Ram Dass called Be Here Now, and that's really what mindfulness is all about. This tends to cause you to be somewhere else now, right? And a social media post, that is not a true post. It's shallow. That is not the way things are. And kids look at that and say, oh, well, I feel I'm not doing as good as they are because look how great they are, what they're doing, they're having a dinner at a restaurant, da-da-da. That's not the true context of what's really going on. John Kabat-Zinn, a guy, PhD, that works at Harvard and other major medical centers, has got a mindfulness-based stress reduction program that they use for taking care of patients with chronic pain, depression, those kind of problems. This is a medically proven technique now. It works. And you can do this anytime that you're doing anything. It's just talking about going off of automatic. So some ways you can do this, do some things differently that you normally don't do. Brush your teeth with your left hand tomorrow rather than your right hand. Eat with your left hand. Every time you take a bite, take your fork and put it down between bites. Things like that. Those create mindful things that you normally do automatically. These are some other resources that you can look at. This book by Charles Francis is quite good. The website mindful.org has got a lot of very interesting things on there. So those are some other things. Walking meditation. Now, most of us, when we walk, we're just walking to get from point A to point B. But you can actually take time and think about what you're doing every step that you take. And there's a method of doing this. There's a guy, Thich Han, is a Tibetan monk, has large walking meditation groups where he gets lots of people and they all walk together in a meditative state. And if you do that, you focus on it, it actually helps that default network go away and makes you more aware of what you do. So that's something you can do the next time you're at the airport. I mean, just zoom through the airport. Well, go slow, take your time, and just notice what you're doing. And it's a very interesting thing, and it actually feels kind of cool when you do it. Zen driving. Okay, how many of us had a wonderful day today driving, trying to go north out there? Well, you know, you can turn your car into a meditative environment if you want to. You don't have to just be grumbling about the traffic or somebody cuts you off or whatever. You can turn on some nice music in there. You can drive and you can look at the scenery. You can actually do something that's peaceful while you're driving. So you can actually make it something positive rather than just automatic going from point A to point B. And there's a whole book about this that you can buy. Meta-meditation. Now, some of you may have heard of the guy Meta World Peace, the gentleman that changed his name, the basketball player. That's because that comes from an ancient Pali word that means loving kindness, and there's a whole type of meta-meditation that uses these phrases of loving kindness that you can kind of use when you're meditating. You can say these things to you. You know, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live life in peace. And then you can say that to other people. May so-and-so be safe. May everyone in this room be safe, etc. So, you know, these things, realize that we sort of tend to think of us as being separate, but we're really not separate as people. We think we are, but let's say a tornado struck this room and killed all of us, we would all be in the newspaper tomorrow. We're all here tonight. You know, we're all connected here. So we think we're separate, but we're really not. We are, but on the other hand, we're really not. We're all connected. If our whole world blew up, say, well, the whole world is gone. We're connected in that fashion as well. And people tend to sort of forget about that, and we really are never alone. One other thing about this business of meditation, we'll talk about this a little bit more as well. How many people, if we're talking, it's not good to be selfish when we're raised? Of course, we all are. Well, there's two types of self. Remember, we were taught by our parents not to be egomaniacs. You know, like in Wayne Dyer said, ego stands for ease God out, is what that means. You're focusing on, that's what you're focusing on, what's in it for me, versus your divine self that's given to you by divinity that you really, it's a gift. And how many of us tend to not treasure that gift? We go on automatic regarding that gift a lot of times. So anyway, those are just a few other things just to kind of think about. Gratitude. There's actually now, you can get a degree in college in positive psychology and you can major in gratitude. Robert Emmons is a pioneer in this. And Kristen Neff, who's a psychologist at the University of Texas, she teaches courses in self-compassion. And she's got a PhD thesis that she did on self-compassion. Very interesting information. Emmons, we actually met him a few years ago, he's a great guy, he's written several books on this. He's got a quote here that I think is very interesting. It's impossible to be grateful and depressed at the same time. Now think about that. You can be depressed and you can be grateful. You go instantly back to being depressed if you want to. But at least in that 1 millisecond, you're grateful. And you're blessed, you're at a meeting. I'm going to go back and be back in my depressed state the next moment. That's fine, you can stay there all you want. But you can also choose to be grateful. So that's something just to remember as well. You can write a gratitude journal. You can think of one or two things a day that you're grateful for. You can write it down. This lady did that. She wrote a book. She said it transformed her marriage significantly. So these are just some interesting things that you can do. We tend to not be grateful on a daily basis. We tend to focus on the problems that we have instead of being grateful about the gifts that we have. Most of us are kind of like this. This is Kristen Neff who wrote this. Positive thoughts about ourselves are like Teflon. They slide right off, but the negative thoughts are like Velcro and they tend to stick. So that's sort of what at least a lot of doctors think of this. I'm not sure if some of you other guys in computer science or whatever, but a lot of us tend to do that. We like to take the baseball bat and turn it on ourselves. If you have a relationship, work on that. That could be helpful to you dealing with stress. And then this. Now this is the one video that I have. How many of you have heard of laughter yoga? There are a few people in the audience. No? You have. Okay, good. Are you gentlemen and women? Are you from India or Pakistan or whatever? Sri Lanka. Well, the gentleman that invented this is from India. His name is Kattan Madarya, and I'll show you a picture of Madan Kattarya. I'll show you pictures. Can I do this, or do you have to do it? To make it play.
Well, I don't know.
Just double click in the middle. I think it'll
play. First, you do number three.
It's not working.
And the second is Albert. And the third one is.
It's kind of contagious. You know, it's pretty cool. And if you do that, this also is used now in hospitals to take care of depression, chronic back pain, things like that. Very interesting, and so it's something to kind of consider. So, what do you experience when you see this versus when you see these? You can just tell the difference your body feels when you just look at pictures like that. So let's spend the last, what time are we going to be done? 8:30?
That's good.
Is that the
you got another 15, 20, or 30 minutes.
Okay, good. So let's talk about the Tao in the last few minutes. This is where it kind of gets more interactive. So this is an old book. Most of you all know what this is. There are a lot of translations out here. I happen to like the one by Witter Bitter the best. Anybody know who he is? Okay, he's an interesting guy that... he's an American poet. He spent time in Asia around the time of World War I, and he started translating these Tang Dynasty poems, and then he got got him to translate the Tao, and he's actually a pretty famous guy. There's actually a Witter Bitter Foundation for Poetry that gives out a poetry award every year. And these guys like this translation also. You guys know who they are? Oh, John, you went in the other one.
Yep.
So he's reading it right here by Witter Bitter. So he's giving an endorsement. This is at the Bed Inn in Montreal in 1969. And when you open up the little book, this is the first thing that you see, the way to do is to be, which is an interesting little profound thing. So what I'd like to do for the next few minutes, we'll stop whenever we want to, I'll present one of these verses. I'm not going to go through all 81 of them. You can read those on your own. Think about a few moments, and then let's talk about them. Take sharing in the group and see what you guys think. And to me, I think it's kind of an interesting thing. So I don't know if any of you have read this translation of his, but I think his are really beautiful. People, through finding something beautiful, think something else unbeautiful. Through finding one man fit, judge another unfit. Life and death, though stemming from each other, seem to conflict as stages of change. Difficult and easy as phases of achievement, long and short as measures of contrast, high and low as degrees of relation. But since the varying of tones gives music to a voice, and what is the was, what shall be, the safest man sets up no deed, lays down no law, takes everything that happens as it comes, as something to animate, not to appropriate, to earn, not to own, to accept naturally without self-importance. If you never assume importance, you never lose it. It's pretty profound sort of stuff there. So we sometimes judge things as one way when it may have a completely different meaning to someone else. And I like this little quote here, what really happened versus what I made it mean. And I remember this little story that I heard a few years ago about where this gentleman was on the subway in New York, and he had three kids, and they were just kind of running around screaming and hollering and just creating ruckus. And he was just sitting there kind of quietly looking down, and looked like he was depressed. And this woman was just kind of, you know, nose up in the air, how dare you know, not take care of your kids, and you're being causing a commotion here, yada, yada. And so she said something to him. He said, yeah, no, I'm sorry, I'm really not being a very good dad right now, but their mom just passed away and just coming from the hospital. So suddenly, it shifted things. Instead of her being kind of the holier than thou, she realized that this was a pretty serious situation. Those kids were sort of just acting out, and he was having a tough time dealing with it also. So take what comes up. You know, we're kind of here to interact with nature. We're not here to control it. This concept of being in harmony with things. We're here to earn. Earn. You guys see Saving Private Ryan at the end of the movie? Where he says, earn this. You know, don't take it for granted. And he didn't take it for granted. You know, he didn't. He lived his life as well as he thought he could. Not to own. How many of us think that the world owes us a living and that we do certain things? The Tao says that's not really true. You know, those lead to the insatiable cravings that we talked about. And then never assuming self-importance where the old pride goes for it all. You know, we can get real puffed up here. Guess what's going to happen at some point? Anybody want to share anything about that? I mean, you guys are philosophers. You got opinions on some things, right? Those of you who read this before, did it sort of, was it moving piece for you when you read it? Yeah.
You know, since I read this many years ago, I've learned more about brain science.
Wait. Oh, yeah, let's get you the mic. I'll take care of it.
So, you know, I think one of the big issues that hasn't been talked about a lot, at least in the general public until maybe more recently, is about the way our brains work and how they're constructed. And like an example would be in some of the education techniques that we use are basically to create a neural circuit that becomes part of our brain anatomy, and so we can be on automatic. 2 + 2 = 4. I mean, we don't, each time we say that or do that, we don't go through the process, we just know the answer. And so this becomes like something you were, what happened versus what I made it mean. We learn things or we hear things over and over again. People watch the same TV channel over and over, and whether they know it or not, they're becoming programmed. And so I'm kind of wondering about this big, huge global problem of how do we change the way we educate, how do we change the way people learn to think, to be more open, or to be out, not thinking you have to be in control. I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I think
I worry about
that. You make a very good point, because I don't think we realize the effects of these things have. It's almost like they're little tiny arrows that get shot at you over and over again. And you don't, you sort of say, I don't feel anything, but they are changing you whether you like it or not. So you can spend your time listening to that stuff on the radio or watching the channels, or you can go look at the stars. You know, you can go out to the Grand Canyon or Big Bend or go to the lake or something like that. Just you have to make yourself get into those positions where you're accepting joy and putting yourself in joyous, awe-inspiring situations. Otherwise, you just kind of get shorn by this stuff. You're automatically just kind of thrown into it. I think you're absolutely correct.
Right.
And I'm not sure we even know how this stuff really affects us. We know it's got to be doing something up here. I agree.
There's a Greek saying that goes along with that. Those that the gods destroy, they first make proud. So
that's cautionary.
And Sherlock Holmes once told his Dr. Watson, you see, but you don't observe. So we see stuff, you know, the Grand Canyon clouds, you know, whatever, but we don't really look at them. We don't even really feel it. Experience
savor, you know, exactly. We don't, but those are the kind of things that you have to sort of step back and start thinking about it. When's the last time somebody said the word awe to you? Or said, did you really savor that last bite of food you took? Did you really experience, were you really mindful about it, or did you just eat and swallow? Remember the next bite? Or that step that you took? So that's all kind of part of it. Here's another one. It is better not to make merit a matter of reward, lest people conspire in contempt. Not to pile up rich belongings, lest they rob. Not to excite by display, lest they covet. A sound leader's aim is to open people's hearts, fill their stomachs, calm their wills, brace their bones, and so to clarify their thoughts and cleanse their needs, that no cunning meddler could touch them. Without being forced, without strain or constraint, good government comes of itself. Now, this isn't a political talk. But this has been called the wisest book in the world. Some of the greatest leaders in the world have spent hours with this book studying this. In China, in the East, they played the game called Go a lot. Have you guys heard of that? Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of game than chess, which is like kill your opponent. It's more kind of like learning how to guide your army across a path in a way. So it's more of a strategic game in a way. And it uses these kinds of approaches in kind of a game. You use a Western sort of kill approach, you're never going to be successful. So this kind of gets back more to like letting the sheep be in the meadow. You know, let them do their thing. You know, you don't need to try to, you know, force them. It's best not to reward accomplishments, because then you make somebody better and somebody worse. In the Japanese baseball, guess what the best thing that can happen is? A tie! They love a tie! They always say, great, we tied! No problem! So, you know, when there's a winner and a loser, there's bad karma that gets produced there. You know, you sort of have that, but there's got to be some way to make that where it's not just every kid gets the trophy. But on the other hand, ego-driven rewards, when they become all important, that's when things go south. So, what is the best way to go? What does it say about regulations? Do we need more or less based on the data? Medicine, we live in a sea of regulations. That's why people are getting burned out and quitting medicine. This is my favorite one of the whole bunch. And it's not politically correct. This is, you know, 2,500 years ago language. So they say man, they mean like mankind, like, you know, Alan Shepard and, you know, Neil Armstrong. Man at his best, like water, serves as he goes along. Like water, he seeks his own level, the common level of life. Loves living close to the earth, living clear down in his heart. Loves kinship with his neighbors, the pick of words that tell the truth, the even tenor of the well-run state, the fair profit, the able dealing, the right timing of useful deeds, and for blocking no one's way, no one blames it. Isn't that beautiful? You know, man at his best, like water, just serve as he goes along. That's the human being at their best, according to the Tao. So what does it say about service? You know, we're here to serve. Serve others. Serve ourselves, not the ego self. So what is your mission for service? You don't have to say, but just you think. Do you have a personal mission statement? Have you ever crafted one for yourself, for your business, medical practice? If we have one in our medical practice. We went through a mission statement process a few years ago. Whenever I ask this to a group of doctors, usually a few hands go up, but not most of them. And you know, there's an old saying, you know, if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. You know, if the proverb said, where there's no vision, the people perish. So you have to kind of have some sort of a personal mission statement in some way. And where does service rank in importance in your work, in your life? Is it here, or is it here? So, according to the Tao, we're best when we're serving as we go along, serving one another, as opposed to always fighting one another, always trying to gain stuff for ourselves. Any thoughts about this passage?
I thought the one in the passage before this, I was getting strong hints of the Lord's Prayer from that. I read the Stephen Mitchell translation, so this is easy for me, but do not seek to show your, I can't remember the words, if you can go back on the, can you go back to the panel? This one? Yeah, that one. Do not excite by display, lest they covet. That one, I was already kind of feeling it, but that really struck me as leading not into temptation. I thought that was always a really interesting part of the Lord's Prayer.
I was wondering about this, why God would ever lead us into temptation in the first place.
Yeah, and it's like we're not even expecting ourselves to resist the temptation. It's just saying, Lord, please don't even show me, because I'm not going to be able to always win out, you know, on overcoming. And this is actually calling us to do that same courtesy for others, in a sense. But like, don't bring about people's bad traits by exacerbating the baser desires that we all know that we have.
Right, anyone else? There you go.
Back up.
We got one over here. Oh, you want to stay on that one or go to this
one? One you were just on.
Jack, just a bit.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say on one of the earlier slides, I saw one of the references that I've always liked in Taoism, which is the reference to the need for balance. You know, it says without a long, there can't be a short, just constantly. And it seemed to me like when I started reading this maybe 10 years ago, I really needed it in the sense that my Christian background and my lawyer background always said, okay, this one's right and that's wrong. And you get this, and an awful lot of it is, well, they're both right, just a balanced approach. And to me, it's very helpful to look at politics, divisions in our country between Democrats and conservatives, liberals and conservatives, and say, you know, we're all they're lacking is balance, accepting the benefit of both viewpoints. So that's what it meant to me.
Yeah, there's something good in everything if you try to look for it. I remember a guy years ago, we were in a seminar, no matter what kind of disorder, what's great about it? So you could say that about anything. So we hear some of your most vile, arch, political rival, what's great about it? Because there is something there, you just have to look for it. So you're absolutely correct.
So there's a couple sentences here that seem like are very timely. Okay. Very, can you hear it? Very timely. About what a leader might do. And it's a couple of sentences there. And I can't imagine this today happening. To have a person in a political leadership role that is trying to clarify other people's thoughts or clarify their thoughts and to cleanse their needs. That no cunning meddler can touch them.
Yeah, I mean, this seems so far away from the way things are right now, like you're talking about. I mean, I just think that, but this is the blueprint, you know? It really has been around for many, many years. And a lot of the old Chinese rulers used to study this and use it. They'd bring in guys like him in to coach them, teach them, bring Confucius in and this sort of thing. So they really were trying to do that. But we're not there today in this country, that's for sure. I don't know if it's a foregone conclusion that we'll never get there. If we give up, there's certainly no chance. But I think that if we just kind of keep maybe just putting this stuff out there, maybe more people are kind of beginning to sort of see this, maybe it kind of gradually, like a low-grade infection, gradually kind of takes over. I'd like to think that this is my second favorite thing. Yes. A leader is best when people barely know that he exists. Not so good when people obey and acclaim him. Worst when they despise him. Fail to honor people, they fail to honor you. But of a good leader who talks little, when his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will all say, we did this ourselves. That's pretty out. It gives me chills up last night. I don't want to read that. This ain't going on now either. In some places it does. Not in Washington. There may be some guys up there that actually do believe this, but probably not everybody. It's totally maniacal up there. But, you know, this right here and serving, you know, I mean, just if you just did nothing, you tattooed those on your arm, you know, the world would be a better place. If you just follow this little thing. So what does this say about, you know, selfless leadership? Jim Collins, from Good to Great, you guys have heard him, presumably.
Yeah.
He wrote this book, and he was actually giving a talk in front of a bunch of CEOs, you know, Ford, you know, IBM, all these things. And he's talking about the level 5 leader. The level 4 leader is like, you know, businessman, driver, alpha male, all that kind of stuff we all think about. The level 5 leader is a servant leader, the guy that drives to work in the Toyota, that wears the tweed jacket, that lives in a 2-story small home, doesn't have a mansion. That's the servant leader. And they're the best of all. He used examples of some of these companies that have been around for 50, 75 years, that had those kind of people at the helm. And so when he finished his talk, all he was rushed by all these people coming up to the station. How do I get to be a level 5 leader? You know, the very driven kind of thing that got them in the level 4 leadership. They couldn't get over that hump. They want to try to bring that to the party, and it doesn't work that way. You know, you've got to be more in flow. You've got to be as a servant. You can't have your ego run the show. Like most of those guys that end up getting indicted and all this kind of stuff that we read about, and they go bankrupt and all this kind of thing. Are you okay with it being them doing it themselves if you really spend a lot of time and energy on it? Now think about that. So you've done all this. They say this, you get no credit at all. Are you okay with that? Really now. Just think about it. It's hard. It's hard. You know, sometimes you do something and then I've had these things happen to me. Somebody will come up to me and say, you know, that thing that you told me 10 years ago, it's changed my entire life. I've done all this and the other, and I had no idea that I've made that kind of an impact on a person. And it makes you feel good when that happens. But that's kind of the way that works. You're doing things along the way, not to take credit, not to own. You know, you're just kind of serving as you go along. And ideally, if you really are kind of moving up in the enlightenment phase of life, you are okay with that. And it's not about you getting credit. So that's something that we have to look at. All of us have to look at. What does this verse say about interpersonal relationships? Dealing with other people there too. So a lot of very powerful things.
This is very confusing, really.
Well, supposedly, Confucius visited Lao Tzu, he was intimidated.
Well, Confucius was all within rituals and rules and regulations.
But it's the same general.
Lao Tzu was, you know, well, get away from all that. But what I was getting at is that it starts at the family level. If everyone, you know, honors their brother, sister, mother, father, etc., and in a reciprocated way, then this goes up to the next level in society, etc., all the way to the leader. And if everybody does this in a kind of a, well, you say selfless, but by knowing their position, their you know, what they should do, they do it naturally in an even flowing way. And that's what Confucius said, that you do this in a way that's effortless.
Yes, more in harmony with things.
Harmony with, you know, that it goes from the family level all the way to the leader. If the leader does this, and a CEO or, you know, Mr. Kelleher or whatever, lead by example,
yes.
You know, and if you're a just person, conscientious, you know, you know, you're a good person, then those under you will also, you know, take that lesson as
Well, yeah, that's a good, very good point. A number of years ago, this woman was really inspired. She wanted to change the world. She wanted to make things better, so she'd been with Mother Teresa, so she calls Mother Teresa and says, I really want to make a difference in the world. What can I do? I really want to make the world a better place. She says, go home and love your family.
Amen.
That was her advice to her.
Amen.
And I think you're right. That's where it starts. You know, what can we do right here, right now? We can't change Washington. But if we do that, it catches on. You know, the best way to decrease a traffic jam on the freeway, they've had scientific studies to show this. The best way? Let the car that wants to get in, get in, instead of trying to be right at the tail of the other car. If the cars let every other one get in, the flow continues. They say the worst thing you can do is try to jockey for your place. If somebody needs in, let them in. And then they let the next person in, and the next person in. And it does create kind of a contagious flow. So that's the truth of that. You want to say something?
I was just reading recently about, you know, I am my own guru, and all the wisdom that I need is already inside of myself, and I am that wisdom. And that doesn't mean that I don't need anyone else. But by what you're saying, you are bringing that wisdom out in me. And so I think that makes it easier to see that, I forgot what it said on the last page, but this, they can get the credit because the wisdom is inside of them.
That's great. That's very good insight. That's really true. The divine engine that's there, if we just foster it and let it grow, it's in touch with the divine wisdom. It's a little tiny piece of it that lives in every one of us. We just get it turned off. You know, the meditators say that they're spending their entire life trying to take things away. So you start off perfect, get a bunch of junk added on, and then you spend all the rest of the time trying to peel all that away. So that's a very good observation. Keep stretching your bow, you repent of the pole. A whetted saw goes thin and dull. Surrounded with treasure, you lie ill at ease. Proud beyond measure, you come to your knees. Do enough without buying, be living, not dying. And this one's kind of similar. The five colors can blind, the five tones deafen, the five tastes cloy. The race, the hunt can drive men mad, and their booty leave them no peace. Therefore, a sensible man prefers the inner to the outer eye. He has his yes, he has his no. Well, that's pretty beautiful also. How many times do we disobey that? We're going to talk about things that drive us crazy, the winds that make the leaves rustle, when our minds really would like to be peaceful. So what does it say about all this kind of stuff? You know, can we have too much? Can we pull the boat too tightly and string ourselves in water and break? And what does this verse 12 say about being true to ourselves? How many times do we just accommodate and say yes when we really mean no? We don't say no when we really should say no. Maybe that's taking on another responsibility. Maybe that's doing something illegal, you know, whatever. So, how many times do we do that in our life? So these are, yes, there's a common factor.
About the beautiful family.
I feel kind of ambivalent about that. If you have a beautiful, perfect family, it just automatically flows out into the community, because like Simone Biles, the world's most accomplished gymnast, was in foster care. And now she is just rocking the gymnast world while her brother is having criminal troubles. Are they flip sides of the same coin, both of them over accomplishing or something? They have the same family and they're polar opposites, and they, and I am so proud of Simone Biles, and I understand that she's competitive and that she's really doing things that it's dangerous for other gymnasts to attempt. Why, is that wrong?
No, I don't think it is. I think there's another quote that I really liked that Heidegger said also a number of years ago. You guys are philosophers, that's a philosophical thing. That there's no inherent significance in anything. So you can be a gymnast and come from this and do something for the greater good of the world, and like she's doing. Or you can come from a gymnast like Tonya Harding and go break somebody's knees and try to, you know, get ahead because you're harming someone else, because it's all about you. So you can be a football player. You can be just about anything and do it for the greater good. Even commit crimes for the greater good. There's a story about some Jewish doctors in Poland that faked a test and made the Germans think that the people had typhus because they wouldn't go there. And they saved probably 500 or 600 Jews there because they were going to come in and raise the town and put everybody in Auschwitz. But they lied and they were criminals. They did it. So that wasn't inherently bad, even though we say it was against the law what they did. So depends on the attitude and the context in which you do it. I don't know their family situation. I come from a family where, you know, one of my brothers is a bad alcoholic. Same family, same mother and father. We got a lot of same genes. So, yeah, I think that a lot of these things are just, you know, did the seed grow in that soil the same way it did in my soil? No. But we both had a lot of the same sort of things. So everything is a little bit different. I'm not a guru. I don't have the answers here. But I can certainly replant these ideas up here and you kind of think about them and say, well, how does that work? So, no, you make a good point. Anybody else? Here's another one that I like too. 30 spokes are made one by holes in a hub, by vacancies joining them for a wheel's use. The use of clay in molding pitchers comes from the hollow of its absence. Doors, windows, and a house are used for their emptiness. Thus we are helped by what is not to use what is. Isn't that interesting? So how many times do we focus on the glass and we're focusing on this part of the glass when really the most important thing is this, the inside. It allows you to fill it up with something. And we tend to focus most of our attention on the hard stuff, on the content, as opposed to the context. So which is more important? You know, obviously both important, but do we tend to sort of forget about this a lot of times? And just focusing only on what we think is right or wrong or the context.
This is one of the prime things that Taoism teaches is this emptiness. To empty yourself, to empty the evil thoughts or the chattering monkey that's in your brain and allow goodness to come in. So this emptiness is a real thing that Tao teaches.
Well, and there's another story about a guy that goes to visit a spiritual master and he says he wants to learn from him and all this kind of stuff. And the guy starts talking and asking all these questions. So the spiritual master, what's happening? It's a tea. And he starts pouring the tea. You've heard the story probably. And he pours the tea and he keeps pouring it. And finally he comes out of the glass on the floor once again. He says, what are you doing? What are you doing? What's going on here? He says, you're like this teacup. You're too full of yourself. You've got to empty yourself and be more open and receptive to things rather than acting like you know everything. So that's an old story there too. How much longer do we? Here's a good. Yeah.
Well, we're
going to
have Q&A. So
is this part of the Q&A? Okay. Yeah. You guys tell me when we need to shut up and leave.
Yeah, we need to.
Sure. Spoke.
Back to that other slide that you just presented.
This one.
Anyway, you were talking about content versus context.
Yes.
I've observed and heard from a lot of luminaries talking about this type of thing. They give the simile of in the first half of your life, you're building the container, establishing yourself, developing the ego would be along with what you're talking about. But then in the second half of your life, you're filling the container. And then there again, they're talking about these kinds of things as opposed to being ego-driven. I personally have experienced and observed that in my friends and relations and in myself and my spouse and so forth. My question here, and I understand you don't represent yourself as a guru or something, but do you have any comment or thought about how we encourage those in the first half of their life to think that way? In other words, to moderate, as it were, their ego, these container building, this self-image building, career, personal, and so forth, and focus it. Personally, I can't say it was like a light switch. In my case, and I'm not posing myself as some kind of perfect or something, but it has come gradual. Would you comment on that a little bit, or any thoughts on that?
It's a really good point that you make, and I guess probably the closest thing I could think of is like what David said, is trying to lead by example. You're talking about maybe being a parent, which is probably the hardest job in the world. A friend of mine said that being a parent is sort of like trying to hammer raw eggs on a tree. It's probably a pretty good analogy. So, I do not have an answer, except I would just say, do the best you can, and you're going to make mistakes. I guess you could kind of think of your behavior in your life is like one giant meditation. One minute, you're going to do things great. The next minute, you're going to be doing something you really wish you hadn't done. Bring yourself back to doing the thing the next time. You're going to veer off cycle, bring it back again. And if you do that a lot of times, maybe eventually you stay closer to that sinful path as opposed to these wild swings or people who just stay out there, you know, never even try to do anything that's, you know, just or some of these kind of things, live by some of these things.
I was thinking in terms specifically of talking with my grandchildren,
yeah,
and in my case, great-grandchildren, about some of these issues.
Yeah, I might get a book.
Yeah.
It's the wisest book that's ever been written, supposedly, so a lot wiser than I am.
That's awesome.
Shall we stop here?
If you don't mind, because they want to get us out of here by now.
I understand completely.
We have some Q&A about any part. First of all, let's give them a quick hand.
I'll end with this slide here. It's an honor to share the session. So thank you guys for letting me come.
Questions? And don't make up a lecture. Make it a question for Dr. Cummings.
Oh, well.
Yes.
So I guess you believe that everything that happens to you is supposed to happen, maybe. Did you attract it?
Well, there's another, yeah, there's no quote, accidents, end quote, you know. There's lots of ways you can phrase that God's got a plan and
yeah.
I'm not smart enough to know what it is and things of that nature. So, yeah, I think that these things are all, when you look at it from 30,000 feet, everything kind of happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. We may not know it, but yeah, I think that's probably true.
Someone else?
Yes.
So, what was your recommended version to read?
Oh, Winner Bitter. Bynner. There's several that are out there. Stephen
Mitchell's
done one that's pretty good. But I just like this one because the way that it's written is beautiful. And apparently the guy that got him to write the book said, well, this is better than I could have ever done. And he was a Westerner. So I just think it's really beautifully written.
That's a good question because I've read several translations of just one line or two lines. And it's so different because of the difficulty of translating from Chinese into
How did you first find out about the
Dada back in, I think it was probably 1978 or 9, I was in Boston. I was taking an elective up there, and I was just walking through the bookstore, and I just happened to go up there, and I saw this book, and I just kind of opened up and started reading it. And I said, that's really cool. I never heard of it before. And so I bought a couple copies and kept it with me, and I still have that original copy that I bought way back in those days. So that's how I found out.
That's what I mentioned part about the one about letting other people take the credit. And basically, to me, that stresses the importance that if you're going to lead something, you should be motivated by the outcome and just being satisfied with the fact that your goal is accomplished. And whether or not someone else or you take group credit or whatever, it's just the real sense of satisfaction is from seeing that need met.
Yeah, I agree. She's got another comment.
This may violate the make it a question rule, but on the translations, I cannot think of the name of the author, but I've got one in my collection that is a verbatim translation with the Chinese character and the ambiguity of meanings, you know, usually four or five in each character.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes I sit down with it and take two or three English translations and look at them all against that one and kind of come up with sort of a guess all, you know, that's really none of them. But it is a fascinating process by which you pick an English word for a Chinese character.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point because you know, a lot of these things are kind of his take on it, and then when you read it, it's your interpretation of what you put into it. So it's really a dynamic sort of thing that when you read these things, it's not like you're reading a novel or something that you just want to get to the end. You look at these things, you think about them, and every time I read this, I get something different out of it, and I feel good after I've read
it. That's what poetry's all about.
Yeah, I just think it's really well done, the way it's done. She's got another
comment. I suppose you are a strong influence in your family.
Well, I hope I've influenced it. You know, I tried to influence my son when he was growing up, and I don't know. And I hope it's taken with him. You never know. So, and my daughter, I've given it to her. She's a senior at UT, and she's in the sorority world and all that stuff. So this probably just goes right over her head. I can't care one whit about it.
I'd like to say something about that. Even though it's not overt,
get away from the speaker.
Okay. Even though it's not overt, you just the way you are, just the way you be. Just the way you're as a father, the way you talk, 1,000 times a day you say don't smoke, like I did. And none of my family smokes. It's just leading by example.
Yep.
You know. And someday you'll say, you know, when they're a teenager, you kind of give up. But eventually they become an adult, and they become a parent, and gosh, you've suddenly become very wise. So I think that's part of the thing, is just leading by example. Two more questions. One more after this, okay?
Okay. No feedback. I'm embarrassed to say there's another Taoist text, the I Ching. And I'm not sure who authored it. Are you?
No, I'm not.
It's not Lao Tzu. I'm not sure who. Yeah, I don't know. But it's definitely a Taoist text, and it's in the spirit of Lao Tzu. And I was just thinking, one of the texts in the I Ching calls you to pay attention to what you feed. What do you nourish? In other words, what are you giving your activities and your attentions to? Because these texts were written a long time ago in a very different kind of society that was agrarian and slow-paced. And so life wasn't like it is now.
you could let your sheep graze, you could let your crops grow. All you needed to do was kind of, you know, keep an eye on things and tend things. Anyway, the thing that I carry with me from Taoism is, what am I feeding today? Where am I getting my attention? Am I giving my attention to junk news? Do I really need to get on Central Expressway today? Is it really that important? Or can I just put that off for another day? Or maybe put it off indefinitely? In other words, we don't have to be as busy as we think we are, if this resonates with anyone.
It does. It absolutely does. And I think that kind of gets back to that verse we talked about a couple of slides ago, that the, you know, craving and all that kind of stuff can drive people crazy, and it can. So I think that's exactly what you're talking to. As far as you're talking about, like, feeding one thing or another, there's an old Native American parable that you have two wolves living in your head. One's the evil, angry wolf, and the other is the soft or peaceful wolf, whichever one you want to make. You want to feed is the one that's going to get stronger. So you can feed the angry one, or the chaotic one, or you can feed the more peaceful one. So that's exactly what you're saying. Oh yeah. There's, how many times do we pick up the newspaper and the front page is like, this person did something really great today and the world is great? You know, the overall, if you take a look at the world suffering overall, it's actually going down significantly. This is the best time in the history of man that we've ever lived as far as human suffering goes. And if you're on the news, you won't see that. But it's actually true. We're in a more abundant world today than we've ever been in the history of mankind. But still, people are programmed to like the negative. We're programmed that way. So you have to work at it. You have to purposely not listen to Rush Limbaugh. You have to purposely not drive on. You have to go out of your way, because the general drift is to be immersed with all that sort of thing.
Well, and it's also our own mind. You're a physician. You're familiar with negative cognitive bias. Our minds are actually programmed to place a lot more attention on negative.
Totally. Yes. It's a survival instinct. So it's counterintuitive to be positive. You know, if you're sitting in the jungle and the lion's going to come up to you, you're sitting there saying, like Alfred Newman, welcome, worry. You know, you're going to eat 9 times out of 10. Yeah. So we're programmed to be anxious. And then you can really fan those flames by, aren't things terrible, and da 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 and all that stuff you want. So we just take that cognitive bias and we just put gasoline on it and light it for the match. So
that's a source of stress, blood pressure, ulcers, and all that.
Shit.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all for having us.
I do want to say that, let's see, the next talk on the talk of November is Crazy Crusades, American Movements of Manias by Dr. Paul Benson. Then on November 26th, yours truly will speak on philosophy and science fiction. And then on December the 10th, Environmental Movements, Nonviolence, and Deforestation.
If anybody found a pair of glasses, let me know, please.
Thank you.
They look like these. There's a pair of laying around somewhere.
Oh, yeah, it's on that laptop. By the way, anybody wants a copy of the presentation, it's on the laptop.
We'll post it on the website.
Yeah.
It was on my page right over there.
If anybody would like to schedule
you're over here by yourself. You have a schedule?
This is what
it is.
Well, whatever. I'll just buy another pair if I have to. No, they're not expensive. I just hate to keep losing them all the time. Well, you can, but I mean,
let me.
I need to get there.
Don't y'all get in the drift?
Well, we're working on getting him out.